Okay, welcome to TBD, To Be Decided, a weekly podcast about culture, politics, news, and other things straight from the heartland in the Susquehanna Valley. This week in the Red Tea, my name is Jordy Comas. I'm here with
Chip Baker
and Taylor Lightman.
And this is our demo recording of this podcast. We want to just briefly introduce what we think the podcast is about. I'm going to give it over to Taylor to talk about that for a second.
Yeah, so thanks, Jordy. Good to be here on the podcast. I think it's going to be kind of a mix of sort of local and national politics, happenings in central Pennsylvania, and hopefully we'll have some guests and talk about a little pop culture, mostly Game of Thrones. And
the best.
Yeah, and I don't know, policies and whatnot. Yeah, we'll see what happens.
Excellent. Would you add anything, Chip?
No.
Okay. Should we talk a little bit just about who we are, like what we think we bring to this podcast? I'll go first. So I'm interested in policy. I'm interested in the link between culture and politics. I'm interested in language and framing. And, you know, I present myself sometimes as the idea guy.
I'm currently unmedicated.
Chip's the grizzled vet.
The grizzled vet.
Political veteran.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm Taylor. I guess I'm sort of the young guy of the group, the millennial, so to speak, quote unquote.
Yeah. But we still like you.
Yeah, okay, great.
But you've worked on campaigns.
Yeah, I've worked on campaigns, and like most millennials in my spare time, kill Applebee's and, you know, other assorted.
What does that mean, kill Applebee's?
There's all these articles floating around the internet about how millennials are killing the
chain restaurants.
And the da-da-da.
Go for it.
Yeah. The real estate market is another one because we're not buying homes.
Oh, you know? Well, that's because the economy. It's not your fault.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's sort of the point. But anyway.
One of the first things we wanted to do, we're going to try this out. We're going to call it This Week in Pennsylvania. We're all from what you might call Trump land places. Chip, you're from, you grew up in?
Texas.
Taylor?
I grew up in central PA right here.
Right. And I grew up in East Tennessee, and I've lived in Pennsylvania for a couple years in Bethlehem, Allentown, and then for the last 15 years here. So when we say Pennsylvania, we like living here. We're not looking down our noses. But that is the way people describe the part of Pennsylvania that's not Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Red Tea. So we wanted to share little insights about what it's like to live here and why we love it. Taylor, you've got one?
Yeah, I've got a great story. So I work part-time in a bookstore, and one of my side hustles with that is I order online CDs and DVDs for Mennonite and Amish people, and I have a delivery today at 3:30 that I got to go to after this, but it's this Mennonite lady that ordered the DVD and the soundtrack of O Brother, Where Art Thou? And I didn't hear from her for like a week or two, but she came back and she asked me to buy two more soundtrack CDs of O Brother, Where Art Thou? So this is number three, two and three that I'm delivering to her today. So I don't know what she wants them, but I think it's a hilarious thing. I sort of feel like a drug dealer, low key, you know.
they read a lot and listen to music because they don't watch TV.
Apparently they don't use the internet though.
No, I mean, it was kind of funny when we were talking about it, because I was working in the bookstore, and she asked me, like, do you have this DVD? And I was like, no. And she's like, where do you want to go? I was like, well, if they don't have it at Walmart, just go on Amazon and order it. And she was just like, no, like, I'm not going to do that.
Why didn't she want to do that?
She doesn't use the internet, probably.
Yeah. Really?
Well, yeah. there's different... We may edit this out, but you know, I was just remembering when we first moved here and we hired a babysitter and we were interviewing her, and she was a young Mennonite gal, and I was all trying to be, you know, Mr. Sensitive Cultural Liberal, and so she, you know, came into the house, and I, you know, didn't want to be too nosy, but she was wearing the classic, like the A-frame dress, but it was a bright Hawaiian floral print. I was like, I thought it was about like not standing out, you know, like that kind of clothes, but like you're in the form, but you know. And then the cell phone went off, and she pulled out her cherry red flip phone. So, you know, great. There's different types. I have a quick little, this is Pennsylvania story. So I was at the grocery store the other day, and, you know, I'm the kind of person, I buy pomegranates, I buy kohlrabi, you know, I'm a sometimes chef.
Food snob. And
yeah, food snob. Well, if the spatula fits, flip with it. But anyway, and so sometimes with the people who are the checkout people, they're like, what is this? And I'm like, you know, that's a pomegranate, or that's a tomato, you need to get out of the store more. But so I had a pomegranate, and the woman who looked like middle America, you know, 40-something, 50-something, she had a wedding ring, you know, I would like to chat with the people at the checkout. And she was like, what is this? I said, that's a pomegranate. And because, I don't know, I'm an ex-educator, I have to drop these nuggets. I said, you know, some people think that was what the apple was in the Garden of Eden, because, of course, apples didn't really grow in the Middle East when the Bible was being written. And she says, oh, that's interesting. You know, I'm always talking to my mom about how the Bible's just metaphors anyway. And I'm like, whoa, because that's not necessarily what I expected. But, you know, there's thoughtful, open-minded people everywhere. And it's that kind of moment where I wish I'd had a card and been like, you know, like, get in touch with us. You know, this one over. She's like, I keep telling her that it wasn't a whale that actually swallowed him. It's just, you know, the difficulties of his life. But what are you going to do? And I'm like, you're going to come to our progressive meetings and, you know, join the cults.
Gosh. Did you say join the cults?
Cause.
Cause?
Okay. No, not the cults. Okay. All right. We're going to shift now to talking a little bit about federal politics, national politics, and then how they play out locally. Chip's going to tell us a little story about our Congressman, Tom Marino.
Where we live and we're...
Sorry, will you do just a little background on him and the drugs are thing?
Tom Marino is our congressman, and he's ineffective, and he's been nominated twice now for a drug czar by Trump. And he had to turn it down the first time, so I don't know why they decided to do this again. It's a real JV ball kind of thing, but... As in junior varsity.
What did you say to me once? Like, we can't even get our corrupt...
Marino's too corrupt for Trump.
Oh, right.
Who's the most corrupt president that I've ever...
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it really, truly
like
is.
Like that hotel in Washington and all the money that sloshes around there.
It's just, it's an amazing time to be alive. But, Tom Marino had a meeting scheduled for our area on the opioid crisis, which is a really, really big deal for everybody. Obviously, this is a situation where we're losing 19 to 20 people a day in the state of Pennsylvania, and we really have to get on top of this. Anyway, he canceled his event at the last minute, and we were obviously going to go. Well, they're not going to let us in, but we were going to go and protest and try and capture the press and try and capture the story. And he canceled at the last minute because he's a coward. And the press didn't even know.
He has a great track record of being available to his constituents.
He has a great track record of being available. He's done, what, one appearance in the last...
By invitation only, I think, wasn't it? That was also a country cover, I think.
The last town hall I went to, like, I went to it. It was a public town hall. I hardly knew about it, but...
How many people were there?
Oh, there were like 25, 30 people there. Because he blasted out on his email, like, probably... What, a day before the event?
Mm-hmm.
But that was like June of 2016.
Mm-hmm.
That was a long time ago. That was like, it's like 400 or 500 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy.
Well, I wonder why they're making him go through this process again, number one. Number two, he'll never get the job. Mm-hmm. So we can just go ahead and realize that this is never going to happen.
There's probably two reasons for that, right? First is how...
That there are 43 people ahead of him for the confirmation process. Do we have those numbers, 42, 43?
It's something like that. But if you could explain that a little more about how that...
Well, it's a linear process. They can only do one at a time, and it's a queue. And so Marino is now 43rd in the queue. So the Senate has to confirm 42 people before they even get to them. And it's going to take months.
Right.
And the confirmation process for Tom Marino is pretty intense. And they're going to ask him a lot of questions about his ties to corruption.
And it's the Judiciary Committee. And then after the Judiciary Committee interviews him and whatnot on C-SPAN and TV and all that good stuff, which I'm planning on tailgating, it goes up to the Senate as a whole, and they have to vote on him. And honestly, I don't think he's going to make it, because
he has no chance of being confirmed. He's got deep ties to organized crime, and they're going to start asking him a lot of questions. And it's not going to be up to Marino or Trump or any of those guys. It's his friends in organized crime who are not going to want the spotlight, period, end of story. So not only is the process going to take months, He's not going to get confirmed, and his friends don't need that kind of heat. Done. So I don't know why they're making him go through this again. It's real amateur hour stuff, but he won't face his constituents. We went to his office a couple of weeks ago to ask for some time. They kicked us out of his office.
Claimed that you can't film them,
and they, it's a public space. They told us to stop filming, even though we could. It's a public space. I wasn't actually in his office, which is a taxpayer-funded office to begin with. But
next to a Gold's Gym.
Next to a Gold's Gym, yeah. So anyway, we have one of the most ineffective and ineffectual Congress people in the country as our representative, and he's deeply corrupt. And it's very frustrating because he wins going away in every election. And, you know, this is where we live. And we have decided to start doing this because we demand better representation. Yeah. We deserve better representation.
And let's be clear here. He gets stuff done for people that give him the big checks. Like, the pharmaceutical companies have given him so much money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he's, you know, passes all this terrible legislation that actually harms people in his district.
Why don't you speak for a quick second, Taylor, about that legislation on the opioid, the DEA.
This wasn't on the agenda. I don't have my notes immediately. But basically, he introduced this legislation that got passed by the House and the Senate, unfortunately. So it's law now, and it basically weakens the DEA's ability to go after pharmaceutical companies by sort of strengthening the clause of defining what clear and present danger is. You know,
he's making it harder for the DEA to prosecute the guys that are putting these to prosecute the people that are putting these pills in our communities.
According to Open Secrets, which is a pretty good watchdog group that collects campaign finance information, in the 2016 cycle, the top industry donating to Reno was the pharmaceutical health product, giving him a total of $72,000.
Which is like 10% of what he raised.
And health professionals is 40,000. That's number four. So that's 110,000, which I don't see his total.
I think he probably raised.
Raised a million. So yeah, that's over 10% just from those two industries.
Crazy.
And I would, since we're on that, let's keep our eye on his FEC report that's coming out in a couple of weeks. That'll be a real indication of where he is. His last FEC report, he raised no money. $3,500, which means he's essentially either retiring or something, but for comparison's sake, the congressman in the district over raised $400,000 in the same period.
Well, let me just kind of throw out my read on this sort of weird situation where Marino was nominated earlier this year and then withdrew for quote unquote health reasons, and is now back in the queue as Chip described, and then this fact about him not raising money that seems to signal he's not really interested in running again. I kind of assume that he's hoping that either the nomination or the drugs are position elevates his profile so that he can move out of Congress, and that's what
he's just, you know, he's not going any higher. There's no elevating this man's profile. He's gone as far as he's going
to
go.
But if he wants to then go through the revolving door, so he's been the drug czar for a year or two, and then he goes and he can work for the pharmaceutical lobbies and even help them maybe protect, I'm thinking out loud here, protect themselves against some of the regulation that may come down the pipeline because we know more and more about their role in the opioid crisis.
You know, I seem to remember.
Does that make sense?
That totally makes sense to me. I mean, this man, you know, I really he could also go back to being the lawyer for DeNaples.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was making $250,000 there a year when he worked for DeNaples after he got fired from
Department of Justice
for not, you know,
for
not
being corrupt.
Yeah, I mean, what's this? He was supposed to be investigating Louis DeNaples, but didn't disclose his friendship with him.
Well, he got a casino. It was the casino license.
I'll bet we could do a future podcast sort of segments and sort of, you know, Game of Marinos or...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, to be honest with you, I am so sick and tired of talking about this guy. You know, this is the House of Representatives. This is a position of immense power, and this man is a putz.
But to
I call your bluff, Chip. I don't think you're tired of talking about Tom.
but to bring this back to this canceled meeting, and one of the things that I know was frustrating to Chip and all of us was... you know, the local media didn't really know it. So this information that you all know about his background, it's not well known in this area. I mean, it's one of the things about living in this area is we don't really have an investigative journalism you know, ecosystem infrastructure, whatever you want to call it. So this tends to be things that people know in their heads and get spread word of mouth. But, you know, we need to raise the profile.
It's all coming out in the Scranton paper, which doesn't have any circulation down here.
Right.
Yeah.
And that, I think that's, we should mention that one of the reasons we're doing this podcast is that we have very little investigative journalism around here. And as a matter of fact, one of the more, one of the bigger circulation newspapers, the Williamsport Sun Gazette, just got bought out by a fracking company. So we really now have to get into...
What is it? McClare? Or?
I can't remember the name because we kind of started doing this before we took notes. But
for accuracy's sake, we should clarify. But yes, they did get bought out by a fracking company.
We decided to do this because somebody's got to. Somebody's going to start having hard conversations. Somebody's going to start digging. And that's
this podcast. Hashtag fuck the corruption.
Oh, my goodness. But we're going to start doing some digging. We're going to start asking some questions. And hopefully we can become a source of information for folks.
Well, let's bring it now from the state, the federal government and congressional level things to more local. Taylor has been a lion of retail grassroots organizing and has been organizing some canvassing, which is...
Love my retail politics.
I think I was going to say unprecedented in this area. I don't know if I can say that with great authority, but
I think it's unprecedented for a municipal election to have this kind of effort. I think we've knocked on something just south of 600 doors since, you know, August or something.
Is that
like
mostly
that.
East Buffalo Township?
It's East Buffalo Township, and probably about 20% of that is in Union Township.
Well, let's put this into perspective: 600 doors in East Buffalo Township. What kind of percentage is that?
Well,
Taylor loves data.
I think there's something like 3,500 registered voters in East Buffalo Township, and you have to assume that
around 2 to 3 is probably average per household. I'm kind of guessing. So that's 1,200 households, to half.
We're getting close here to, you know, we're maybe half, maybe.
I think it's
maybe a third or something like
that. I think one thing that people don't – sorry, Chip – but that I think is really important about East Buffalo, and you know, if anybody's listening who's not from this area, is that this is a mix of very rural farmland area with basically suburbs. Lewisburg is the core. It's a small town, like 7,000 people in the borough, we call it. But the just on the edge of it is a lot of suburban development, and it is – just a very purpley area. There's a lot of registered Democrats in that area, but there's a lot of Republicans in that area, but also out into the rural areas. It matters for us because it's a real kind of a local bellwether.
It absolutely is a local bellwether. Just to give you a little history here, 2007 goes Democratic, Jim Buck wins. 2009 goes Democratic.
For supervisor. Which if you're not from Pennsylvania, is basically the executive branch.
It's executive and legislative.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
And they serve 6-year terms, rotating.
The guy that Jim beat was both a supervisor and the roadmaster, which has got to be one of the coolest government titles out there.
Yeah, roadmaster. Yeah.
Sounds like something from a Mad Max movie. I am the roadmaster. Anyway.
Yeah, so 2009 Jim Buck wins, 2007 Jim Buck wins, 2009 Tom Zorn wins, Democrat, kind of a centrist though. I think he worked in HW's White House.
Mm-hmm.
2000. Really? Oh yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. 2011 Hank Baylor, who's sort of our local.
He's a moderate.
Lindsey
Republican.
Graham, John mm-hmm. McCain. Ran unopposed, and this is
when you say that you should edit this out. I think I always think about how John McCain and Lindsey Graham are like so close that like there's some comedian who talks about them being lovers.
Oh yeah,
they this call him Grandma Graham.
This is
edit
a
that out.
Yeah. No. Just to riff off this, I remember listening to a podcast about it was Barney Frank. They were interviewing Barney mm-hmm. Frank, and Barney Frank was talking about how in the early 2000s there was a move to censure. LGBTQ Americans and strip them from their security clearance, like congressional. Mm-hmm. And Barney Frank apparently testified and said, "If this goes through, I will consider it, a personal mission to out every single member of Congress who's closeted homosexual." Right. And it never got passed.
That's the stupid thing is I've had family members who worked in national security is the ones who are out are the least susceptible to blackmail because you don't have
exactly.
anything on them. So
exactly.
It's just stupid.
Yeah,
it is.
Whatever.
It
so.
Is. Anyway.
So yeah, 2011, Hank wins unopposed. And then the last two elections we really – The 2013 election was really close. I think the Democrat lost by 19 votes, but I'm also biased because I ran the campaign. 2015, we got totally crushed, mostly because of this affordable housing unit that that is built now that people were really upset about.
We should mention that it was just racism.
It was...
You should mention that it was just racism.
Okay, I'm going to say that it was a lot of... Well, there was some overt, but there was a lot of dog whistle racism, and I think that's an interesting topic at some point to talk about, because sometimes I think the left is still trying to, you know, fight against overt kind of Jim Crow racism, and the dog whistle racism needs other tactics.
It wasn't they weren't against low income; they were against black.
No, I agree, but I'm saying sometimes, because I know people who live there, and a guy who I like and know from the community, and he was like, well, I was worried about my property values, and for me to be like, oh, like you racist, like that's a non-starter.
Yeah, well.
I was listening to this one interview, and it was saying, you know, with dog whistle racism, the leftists are going to get it immediately, mm-hmm. and of course, like, people of color. Mm-hmm. And then people that are centrist, mm-hmm. You know, like, quote-unquote normies, they're just totally not going to get it and are going to be really confused when the leftists start their outrage circus.
Yeah, the outrage circus is good. Yeah, like so this canvassing, though, I mean, how much, you know, how hard is it to organize canvassing in a, you know, our friend Dwayne has got an opportunity year election. There's no congressional election. There's no gubernatorial election. There's no presidential election.
Let's remind everybody, every year is an election year, and the municipal races are as important as anything out
there.
And everybody listening needs to be active at every cycle.
All four people.
My mom's going to listen.
My wife.
My mom's going to listen, too.
All right, there's three.
How do we monetize this?
Yeah. So I don't know. In some ways, it's you have some people that care a lot about it, and they're not hard to, you know, like, just reach out to them, and they care a lot about it because there's actually a lot at stake here.
I think also, though, I haven't been out canvassing yet, but you know, tell me if I'm right that, like, this is the fun kind of canvassing. I mean, it tends to be people in your neighborhood or in your community, and, you know, it's not like being shipped out to some other part of a state where you don't even know the name of the streets. You know, you end up having other conversations.
And, like, the thing is, if you go out and talk to people about, like, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, like, they have so much – there's already so much there. Like, and, like, granted, you it is, like
– Right.
I will advocate going and canvassing on big national stuff. But local stuff, people sort of, like, don't really know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And some people know a lot about what's going on. So it's it's fun canvassing. You know, you're talking about people, you know, talking with people about, you know, things like the rail trail, you know, the community pool, stuff like that.
Who are you canvassing, by the way? Just D's?
Chip means Democrats.
Yeah. just people whose last name starts with D.
Yeah, just the D's.
We lost because we didn't canvass the G's and the H's.
Yeah.
So we're actually canvassing, you know, this sounds terrible, everybody except for Republicans. Independents, Democrats, people registered in the Green Party.
Regular voters.
Libertarians, yeah. Just
people who vote in every cycle, people who vote in most cycles.
Any registered
voter.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
I think sometimes we self-select too much, and it ends up, you know, sort of, you know, we're crippling ourselves.
You're narrowing the field too much.
All right. So we're going to shift to something we're going to call Policy of the Week, POW. So we want to talk a little bit more about the opioid crisis, which is, at least to my perspective, in the last, you know, 12 to 18 months, gone from something that's been around, but the salience of it, you know, the people's awareness that this is an issue to talk about is just accelerated so quickly. You said 19 people. I've heard 14 people, 19 people.
19, according to Attorney General Josh Shapiro at the event last week.
So 19. He said 19?
Yep.
I mean, you know, that's a day.
A day.
A day in the
that's
country.
Crazy.
It is. I know. I've also
in
seen
the
that.
State.
In the
state.
Oh, in the state.
In PA.
Oh, okay. I've also seen, you know, that in terms of it's surpassed traffic fatalities for what would we call these, like, you know, not natural causes or
in a recent Jacobin article by Jonah Walters, he said it was the equivalent of a 9/11 every 3 months.
Right.
And nationally.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. So just we're just touching this briefly. I know I'm just at the beginning of my learning curve for understanding the different pieces of this. And there has been some attention on the role of the medical profession and doctors and nurses and other healthcare professionals. to get the drugs out. But there was just a thing in today's New York Times based on some research that insurers also have had a real significant role in this. And this is one of these things where maybe it's malice or maybe it's just profit seeking that ends up having malicious effects. But essentially, lots of the most addictive drugs that are available are on their lists that they don't need approval. So if a doctor's making a prescription, they can just write that prescription. Whereas the painkillers that people need who do have chronic pain, the ones that are less addictive, right? In other words, you're less likely to get addicted to, cost more. So there's this really perverse incentive for the insurers to say, take, I can't remember the names of the drugs, but take this drug that is 29, there was one example, it was $29 a month that cost them rather than a patch. I think one was like a lidocaine patch that was like $340 a month for a youngish woman in her 30s who has these chronic pains. And, you know, I'm just going to say, like, for the most part, I think there's a lot of overuse and overprescription. But I do know somebody in my church who has a horrible condition that has chronic pain. And we don't want to – there are, you know, chronic pain as a diagnosis did emerge in the 90s. And we don't necessarily want to go back to the quote-unquote dark ages of just saying those people will suck it up, you know. Yeah. We've got to hit the right balance.
You know, we should mention, I mean, you know, you have the heroin and then you have the fentanyl. Mm-hmm. And now we have carfentanyl. And we're talking,
you know, your knowledge of these worries me sometimes.
No, we had the officer come from East Buffalo Township and speak to us about it. And I mean, we're talking literally micrograms of this stuff is lethal.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's crazy.
It really is crazy. You don't have to take pills for an extended period of time to have a problem. You can have a problem right away. The first one.
Yeah.
You take one and you could be done.
In terms of addiction or death?
In terms of addiction health and death. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Anything else to add about the opioid crisis? When we get further along, we have like show notes. That Jonah Walters piece in the Jackman is really well written.
Yeah, I would love to have him on as a guest.
Oh, that's a great idea.
It
doesn't even matter if he's here.
You can call him in.
Okay, we're going to end with something we're going to call beer chatter. So everybody gets around 30 seconds to talk about some interesting thing going on. You know, what would you talk to people? I stole this from another podcast where it's called Cocktail Chatter, but that sounds too highfalutin.
Yeah. I'll spare my beer chatter and just put a quick plug in for Medicare for All. I think Bernie has 15 co-sponsors or something like that, which is like a third of all the Senate Democrats. These health insurance companies are corrupt as hell. That's my cocktail chatter.
Beer tail chatter. You got one?
Oh, I don't know. I'll go with Taylor. I like what Taylor said.
Okay, you guys don't understand the purpose of this.
Well, why don't you start then?
All right. So mine is I was listening to a podcast called In Our Time, which is I shouldn't say this, is so like Birkenstock wearing liberal. It's a BBC podcast with a bunch of British academics talking about different things. They're talking about Rosa Luxemburg, who I don't know. Anyway, she was a just total firebrand radical in like the 1900s, 19-teens, 1920s, and she was a Polish Jew who had a limp and couldn't vote. She also lived in Switzerland, but she's most famous for being in Germany, and she was an amazing writer. And one of the things that stood out for me was she just wrote so beautifully about the role of she called like spontaneity in social change and social revolution, and how it's this force that sort of wells up from people being engaged and involved, and it's something that's necessary and it can't be controlled. And she and Lenin would go head to head. I did say Lenin on a podcast, head to head over this, but you know. I think sometimes as current day like progressives and liberals, there's a certain, at least in my experience, there's a certain like everything that was sort of near organized communism might be problematic. But I think it's important to go back and look at these people who were overtly anti-authoritarian, and Luxemburg was one of those people. And I found it really, you know, that she was talking about the same kinds of things that we're seeing today. The role of spontaneity. We talk about grassroots energy, but it was the same thing.
Absolutely, yeah. Second that.
Okay, so this is the end of our demo podcast.
I will just say that it's sometimes really stifling to go to an action or a meeting or something like that that's already planned out for you. You just have to be a warm body. It's just I don't think it's that engaging,
right.
And I don't think that's a good way to bring people into the movement. You know, we should start off by giving people a level of responsibility. Mm-hmm. You know, and some autonomy.
Yep.
It's Mueller time.
Peace out. Okay, that went really well.